Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. Today should be the last day of the three-part series that we're doing on the Common Core. We have a lot to cover, so we're going to try and hit the ground running very quickly. But I would like to take a moment and just review something in terms of what I think I've said in the past, but for those who missed it, this is a three-part. Today is the third of a three-part series. It all started when the author of the book that we're going to be talking about listened to one of the shows, maybe 6 weeks, 7 weeks ago, and for some insane reason, she thought I was pretty decent, pretty good at understanding what is happening in public education from my standpoint in terms of the war on public education, that somehow she was under the delusion that I got it. I really understood what was going on. Her book had just come out, and she thought I would make a really good person to get a review written on her book. She contacted me. I said yes, and by the time I got the book, I had already decided that in addition to trying to write a short paragraph, I wanted to have her on the show. By the time I finished reading the book, I realized one show was definitely not enough, that two, three, or four shows would be possibly adequate, and so I convinced her to hang around for almost a whole month and discuss her book, have a conversation over her book. And that's where we are today. We have a lot of ground to cover. And Deb, welcome back to the War Report.
And thank you. It's always good to talk to you, James.
Oh, see there? She always says that. Now, whether or not she believes it or not, I don't know, but she always says it.
Well, ask me at the end of the hour.
You have gotten everything you wanted by then. Okay. Now, let's start. You remember where we left off? We left off at the beginning of Chapter 7. And today we're going to go through 7, 8, and 9 in the conclusion. You sort of touched on some of the content of 7 and 8. And even 9, when you talk about the gorilla in the room. So let's take off from where you want to go.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about something at the very beginning, and I think it provides a rationale for why I think our conversations are so helpful in the movement. And that is that, again, today in the newspaper this weekend, coming out of Long Island, was an editorial. Basically, referring to the movement, the source of the movement against high-stakes testing and the Common Core as some sort of conspiracy. And I wanted to reiterate this. First of all, yes, it's Machiavellian, but there's no conspiracy. There's only history. There's no secret cabal. The only thing secret about the Common Core was actually the writing process itself. But there's no cabal in itself, just policies that result in the privatization of education with corporations taking the lead. There's no single genius person behind a curtain wielding the levers, just a bunch of people, the one percenters, who have plenty of money to support their free market ideology and in the long run and short run make a lot of money for themselves and their friends. And so I wanted to clear that up because there truly is no conspiracy. The history will show us that this has been a long time a coming. And for those who want to believe that the Common Core was a result of simply Obama and Duncan, they're mistaken. And I think that's the one thing in the book that becomes patently clear, is that the Common Core was in the works from the get-go. Last time we talked about the Palisades Conference, where Lou Gerstner brought together the governors who were the CEOs of the states, and they had to bring a friend, and they brought a friend who was a CEO of a major corporation. And so there was this 50-50 alignment between governors as head of their states with the corporate leaders within their states to promote education reform en masse. And so that's where we left off. And at the Palisades Conference, the biggest thing that came from that was the birth of the group ACHIEVE. ACHIEVE would be the group that would write the Common Core. But they actually started their work a lot sooner than people realized. It was 11 years before they started working on the official Common Core state standards. But in 1998, they announced the beginning of the Academic Standards and Assessment Benchmarking Project, 1998. That's a long time ago. And I think what's clear from that is we can see that from the very beginning, the standards were always tied to the assessments, and the assessments became the de facto curriculum. And so this was done, beginning a long time ago. In 2001, we have a couple of things that are happening that I think are really critical to understanding the creation of the Common Core state standards. In 2001, most of us in the general population associate 2001 with a couple of things. One, of course, 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened, and then George Bush in office began working on the No Child Left Behind. So the country was reeling in a number of ways. I mean, first of all, we were trying to come to grips with the new realities of our country, the Supreme State, the NSA, and all of the things that are associated with that. Within a couple of months, the reality is, and historians have pointed out, that all of the wrangling that went into No Child Left Behind sort of took on a new meaning with 9/11, because George W. Bush needed a quick victory in Congress. And so we had the bipartisan passing of No Child Left Behind. I was a teacher then, James, in early childhood grades, and the effect that No Child Left Behind and Reading First had on us was so profound. We were having to just come to grips with just this entire structure of the federal government in our classrooms, monitoring not only what we taught, but how we taught. And so while that's going on, if you remember a couple of weeks ago when we talked about the Clinton's third way of governance and how policies now were being made in what's called the deep state. In the deep state, the corporate world is aligned in a bipartisan or nonpartisan way with both the Democrats and the Republicans, and they're making policies with the corporate world at the table at every policy discussion. And so no longer did we have policies that were simply government policies, but these were really, in fact, corporate policies. So while that's going on, the whole nation is watching Washington, D.C. when it comes to education policy. And they're thinking, this is where it's all really happening. But in fact, it was ACHIEVE and National Governors Association and the CCSO, the Chief State School Officers Association. They were behind the scenes with their private club hashing out reform writ large. And so when ACHIEVE convened in 2001 to announce the beginnings of their project, which would become the American Diploma Project, and that's where the Common Core really has is being formulated in 2001.
So that puts to rest any notion that the governors themselves played any role, not only in tiny role, but no major role in the actual putting together of the Common Core standards. What you're saying, and what I think hopefully by now all of us should realize, is that from the very beginning, this was a corporate slash business community project. It was power of the purse, power of the influence that money can buy, that had an agenda, that had been there for a long, long time. You and I talked about this going, but you take it back to the 1930s. I take it farther back, a lot farther back than that. And what we see here is a total refutation of any notion that this was a government conceived, developed, promoted set of standards aimed at really helping teachers and our kids get a much better education. What we have
is a
set of standards that the business community have always wanted, and now through certain events were able to finally have their way.
Right. To illustrate that, James, this is an important point. In 2001, we had 9/11 in September. In October, on October 9th, the National Education Summit, achieved the National Education Summit, went forward. They weren't stopped. Not even the bringing down of the Twin Towers could stop the train of education reform by the business community. And it's almost chilling when you think about it. The birth of the Common Core State Standards by Achieve. Only 15 governors attended that National Education Summit. Only 15. It's not even a quorum, is it? So, but the corporate world was there. They had their displays ready and up and going. And so this 15 governors who were at the 2001 summit, sponsored by the Fordham Institute, the Fordham Foundation, and the Education Trust, launched the American Diploma Project officially in 2001 with only 15 governors in attendance. And then they have the gall to say that this was state-led and that the governors had anything to do with it. They relinquished all of their policy decision-making to the corporate world at that point. Now, 2001, within 3 years,
before you go any further, Achieve, the major player in all this. Tell the people who and what make up Achieve.
Well,
Achieve
is, right, it's an organization that was started by the National Governors Association and the CCSSO, the State Chiefs School Superintendents Association, basically. They're highly funded by the private sector. That's very, very purposeful. First of all, we know that the federal government has been prohibited by the ESEA and by the organization, the law that organized the Federal Department of Education. The federal government cannot be involved in curriculum building or even influencing the curriculum. It is absolutely strictly forbidden. And so in order to make it happen at the federal level, to get the federal money churning within the private sector around education reform, they had to have a private entity. And so this is a private entity funded by major corporations to develop standards and assess. And they have been, now we associate Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation highly with Achieve because he's one of their major funders. But then Bill Gates funds everyone. So he's been, anything that has to do with education reform, he drops a lot of money into it. He provides funds for candidates on the right, candidates on the left, anybody who can influence his agenda with education. So Achieve is definitely a private entity, but they are key in this new era of deep state governance, third way governance, where policies are not made by the federal government. they are rubber stamped and enforced by the federal government, but they're actually being made by the corporate world. In the United States, and as you and I have spoken, this is a worldwide phenomenon. So that's Achieve. Now, in 2004, Achieve produced a document through their American Diploma Project called Ready or Not, Creating a High School Diploma That Counts. Now, what's important about that document is they have, if you look at the Achieve website, they will tell you that what they have done with this document is to identify the common core, and they use the term the common core of English and math benchmarks. And on their website, they will tell you that Education Week names that one document, Ready or Not, as one of the most 12 influential research studies at that time, 2004. By 2005, the American Diploma Project was launched in 13 states. And so it's already taking hold. Now, keep in mind that for those of us who were teaching at the elementary school level, we were feeling pains of No Child Left Behind earlier than any of the other grades. And it absolutely revolutionized and how we taught reading. For the American Diploma Project, they started with the high school level. And so it was very Machiavellian in the sense that they were working on the writ large education reform policy where No Child Left Behind and the federal government were overseeing and with the iron fist on the elementary grades on up. And then the American Diploma Project was pushing down from the high school level. By 2006, they had produced a document called Closing Expectations Gap, an annual 50-state progress report on the alignment of high school policies with the demands of college and work. And they're continually moving forward. And then in 2008, now let's think about 2008. I think sometimes we forget to put everything
Obama
in the context.
Factor comes in. The Obama
factor. There's your Obama factor. Right.
Okay.
Right. That's the Obama factor, and our country was in the midst of the biggest recession our country had experienced since the Great Depression. So everybody was feeling the pains of an economy gone bad. So the American Diploma Project now publishes a document called Out of Many, One, Toward a Rigorous Common Core Standards from the Ground Up. The Common Core. So when people talk about the Common Core State Standards in 2009, they're missing the fact that they had, in December of 2000, they had already published something that they're calling Common Core Standards. And here's another interesting point. In 2008, The American Diploma Project and Achieve was already asking governors to sign memorandums of understanding, MOUs. In other words, get on board with the American Diploma Project. And in 2008, 51 states and territories had already signed the MOUs. So here when we have in 2009 and 2010 raised to the top, we have to understand the governors were already in cahoots with the whole thing. They were not surprised by the Common Core State Standards. They had already been involved with signing memorandums of understanding for common standards, common state standards. So that's 2008, and then we have 2009. Obama's inaugurated as president. And to deal with at that same time, less than a month after he's inaugurated, here comes American Diploma Project with another document, benchmarking for success, ensuring U.S. students receive a world-class education. So in 2009, in February, we had the supposed solution to our economic problems in the country, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And Arne Duncan was absolutely giddy because the Department of Education was awarded $4.35 million to fund Race to the Top. Race to the Top, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, really, you know, brings in the Common Core as the gorilla in the room. It was the perfect storm for reform. And I think one of the most interesting things, and the thing that really points to how involved the corporate world was in this whole debacle of Race to the Top, Arne Duncan hired a person named Joanne Weiss to run the Race to the Top program. He needed somebody who knew how to deal with big money, who knew how to deal with the corporate world, you know, licking their chops trying to get at the money. And so he hired Joanne Weiss. Now, Joanne Weiss is significant because she, prior to joining Arne Duncan's Race to the Top initiative, she worked for an organization called the New Schools Venture Fund. The New Schools Venture Fund was basically an organization that was in charge or took the responsibility of marrying people who had ideas for the private sector in education with hedge fund managers. And they don't even shy away from their role. It's like a go-to. If you have some money and you want to make more money or you need money to make more money, whether it's charter schools or you have an idea for technology to be used in the education sector, they will help you find the funders to implement your plans and your projects. So that's who Arne Duncan hired to run the Race to the Top initiative. And that would have profound impacts on how education reform would play out. So I think one thing that...
Let me stop you for a moment, Deb. Yes. You mentioned in the book that this was basically, for Arne, the equivalent of a perfect storm.
Yes.
And that you have the recession of the greatest recession since the 1930s. You have the coalescence of corporation or the commercial entities coming together. You have them pulling the strings of state governors and state superintendents of school. You have Congress providing the money. You have all of a sudden the Department of Education having more money at its discretionary money at that to deal with, so that, as you mentioned earlier, here's Duncan, totally unqualified for the position, folks, that's my position.
Yes.
Licking his chops. This is New Orleans all over again in terms of a perfect storm.
Right, right.
This gives Arne Duncan power that no other Secretary of Education has ever had, individually or collectively up to that point. This is major, as you just stated. This is awesomely major. Just a little aside.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Arne Duncan was bragged about the power that he had when he announced the Race to the Top initiative. It reminds me, you mentioned New Orleans, and we have to remember that, you know, Milton Friedman, before he passed away, made the comment that this was the best thing, that Hurricane Katrina was the best thing that had ever happened in New Orleans, because then they could remake the school system based on free market economic ideas. And Arne Duncan echoed that. There's a truism with Friedmanomics, and that is that whenever you have a crisis, that's the time to rush in and implement free market ideas, because everyone's scrambling. There's a crisis. And even Rahm Emanuel, who would go on, obviously, to Chicago fame or infamy.
Infamy.
Made the comment on the news one time. He said, never let a crisis go to waste. So he was buying into this whole free market crisis mentality. And there's another truism that I think fits well with what was going on in 2008, 2009. One of the truisms of free market economics is the concept of starving the beast. And what that means basically is this.
Austerity.
When you have a time, Yes. You dry up the public money that's available to keep things going. And as you're drying it up, then the free market can rush in and private entities can rush in to save that entity. That's exactly what happened in 2008 and 2009. States were in distress. They didn't know how they were going to keep the school doors open. The federal money was drying up. The states were scrambling to figure out how to provide for the budgets of their public schools. And so here comes Arne Duncan with the Race to the Top initiative, and he's going to save the states by implementing the Race to the Top policies. And again, the gorilla in the room. Oh, my God. It would be one thing if it was just the Common Core. That would be easy to deal with. We would say, hey, that's not the federal government's role. You need to stay out of state curriculum issues and standards business and let the states run their own, establish their own curriculums. But he also brought in all of those other things, the charter school initiatives, the VAM model for, catching a teacher's accreditation level and their ability to keep their job to the test scores, the non-traditional licensure programs where TFA teachers could come in and serve for 2 years in high-need schools, and all of the other things that the beast carried with it. And so now we're left with the Race to Top policies that, you're right, it was discretionary funds, but they totally transformed education and education policy. So that's 2009, and we have a hedge fund manager basically running the Race to the Top initiative. In 2009, April, just 2 or 3 months after the Race to the Top monies were made available, the NGA, the National Governors Association, along with the CCSO, met in April and discussed the rollout, the creation of the Common Core state standards and their plans for getting that going. Now, here's where it gets really hinky. Like I said, all of this is done pretty much in the open. You can look on the internet and Chief's website. They basically proudly proclaimed their role in creating the Common Core state standards. But when it came to actually writing the standards, that was done in a very secretive way, and a way that makes it very difficult to even establish a timeline for when these things happen. And so in the book, in order to make sense of the Common Core State Standards creation, I looked at it from the standpoint of the different stages and how they went through creating the standards. So the first stage that they discuss is the establishment of the College and Career Readiness Standards, the CCRS, or sometimes we refer to them as the Anchor Standards. These were the standards that basically said this is what high school seniors need to be able to do in order to be prepared to go either into college or into a career. So that was stage one. In May 2009, the work groups were established, and they got busy with supposedly the CCRS first, and then the stage two would be taking those CCRS standards and then creating the K-12 standards. So you see, in that it sounds logical the way they did it, but if you think about it and you look at their timeline, it all kind of falls apart. Before I begin, sort of talking about that a little bit, I want to recommend a video to all of the listeners. It's the video called Building the Machine, and it's been posted on Facebook a few times recently. I can't recommend it enough. It is you'll hear from people who actually worked on the standards and the problems that were inherent in not only the creation of the standards, but the standards themselves. So then, after you have stage one and stage two,
before we move on, you should provide a link on your page. Send me the link, and we'll provide it on our pages. And of course, we'll do everything we can to get it out to as many groups as possible. I've seen it. I think it's a wonderful piece, and it is definitely worth sharing and spreading around, so we can do that.
Yes, I think that's important. I was planning on doing that after we talked, as a matter of fact. And then there's another group called the Validation Committee. So those of us who've been involved with research and we understand how that works, validation is the key to everything in research, and particularly when it comes to standards. So the Validation Committee becomes really key to understanding the process when you listen to some of the people who were on the Validation Committee, like Sandra Stotsky and Jim Milgram. So in 2009, let me just briefly say, May 2009, the work groups are formed, and they're supposedly in the middle of creating their standards, always keeping in mind that the standards had already been pretty much written at the high school level with the American Diploma Project. So that work, you know, they try to portray it on their website like this the work began then, but we know that the work was already had already been done in large part. A lot of the people that you see showing up on the Common Core State Standards in their work groups were people who had been involved since the 90s. Susan Pimentel, who did work on standards that were funded by the Walton Family Foundation and supported by GE and other corporations. She's a key player and one of the primary writers of the Common Core. Jason Zimba and David Coleman are very, you know, we're very familiar with them. What people need to know about those two is that they met in Oxford. When Coleman came back after getting his a degree in English literature from Oxford, tried to get a job as a teacher, it's been reported, and was unsuccessful. And so he went to work for an organization that was involved in education reform and free market ideas globally. And he and Zimba became friends at Oxford and started hashing out a plan for something that's called the GROW Network. They would later sell it to McGraw-Hill, make a ton of money. The three of them, by 2006, they are creating an organization, Student Achieve Partners, SAP, and so they're already in this game together in the on the corporate side of making education standards. So they're, you know, they've already been involved with this, and they're very aware of the American Diploma Project. So that work supposedly began in May 2009. By September 2009, they're announcing the Validation Committee, and by now September 24th, 2009, the Validation Committee is officially announced. However, the Common Core readiness standards were available based on the information on the Achieve website between September 21st and October 21st. That's really significant when you think about the fact that these standards were available for public comment before they had actually been validated by the Validation Committee. And that's where Sandra Stotsky, she's been very public in this, in that she said, that committee was put into place really as a rubber stamp, just to say we have a validation committee and they're doing their work, but they were not listened to. And as a matter of fact, the validation report, when it was finally published, Sandra Stotsky noticed that of the 30 people that were on the validation committee, five of the people had not signed it, had not signed off on it. Now, that's significant when you think about it. Five of the people on the validation committee refused to sign the statement that the standards were indeed valid. You'll find that, you know, the readers can, when you watch the video, Building the Machine, you'll see she speaks about that.
Oh, by the way, it's already up on our site. It was up 20 minutes ago.
That's too cool for words, James. That's amazing. And that's actually what's available on the internet is one part of it. There are actually discs that people can buy if you want to share them with your parent groups and teacher groups. You may want to go ahead and buy the three discs. And then there's another one that's on available on YouTube. That's the parent interviews, and I think they're very significant, too. And we'll talk about some of the things that they say on the parent interviews are really revealing as well. So here we have these standards, and they're just rushed out at breakneck speed. I mean, in Massachusetts, Massachusetts has been acknowledged as having some of the best standards in the United States. But it took them a long time to develop those standards. I don't know why they would even consider adopting the Common Core State Standards, to be honest with you. I read an article a few months ago in the UK, one of their government leaders, the head of their education department, cited the Massachusetts standards as being world-class standards, like some of the best in the world. How ironic that, why didn't we just all adopt the Massachusetts standards? I have no idea. And so the whole issue of the Common Core State Standards, even they were not validated in truth. Any public comment that any time of public comment, those comments were seemingly ignored. And as a matter of fact, with the creators of the Common Core and Achieve, they make some kind of reference to, well, they knew that the comments were not, it was not a scientific measurement of the true feelings of the United States when they finally completed their work. In other words, they didn't trust the American public's comments, and so those got sort of shoved off to the side. There's no way that in the time period that they said that they created the Common Core State Standards that they could have been truly representative of a democratic process. It just didn't happen, James. And if you read deeply, if you do, like David Coleman says, do a close reading. If you do a close reading, you'll see where the intentions were never to create a set of Common Core State Standards that would be acceptable to the United States in general. And so that's about the creation of the Common Core State Standards. It was done in secret, and Sandra Stotsky points out they had to, on the Validation Committee, sign a confidentiality agreement agreeing to never discuss what was said in their meetings. And that's so un-American, so undemocratic, that in and of itself should be a rationale for why we should reject these standards, and we should go back to square one and rethink this whole idea. Some of the things that I've been following, I think a few weeks ago we posed a question: what are the problems with the Common Core State Standards? To kind of get an idea of the pushback. And again, that video explains some of the things that have happened and some of the problems with it. I think that's something we want to discuss a little bit. The standards themselves.
I'm hoping that we will do a show maybe in June around that survey that you are participating in with Chris and the woman from New York. The original plan was to have that survey and do it, I think, our first show, but that didn't work out. So now I'm going to try and schedule it for sometime in early June and have the four of you, the three of you on. So the four of us will talk about it. And so you can sort of like skip over that a little bit.
Okay. All right. I think at this moment I do want to give a shout out to New York and the opt-outers because we are rocking it right now, I have to say, and causing a lot of discussion about the whole nature of it. And I think that's another thing we want to watch too. First of all, Pearson's stock seems to be dropping, and that's where you hit them in the pocketbook. And the other thing is that there seems to be some discussion about trying to squelch that movement and hold teachers accountable. Okay, so the validation committee itself never did its work, and I think what we can see is that the Common Core State Standards were not a Democrat. It was not a Democratic process. The same people who were promoting the American Diploma Project were pushing very, very hard to put the Common Core State Standards in place. And it's interesting now, to listen to the presidential candidates as they enter the fray, trying to come to grips with the American public's reaction to the Common Core, and how they're going to play that out in their presidential elections. So we have the Common Core State Standards, people on the left, people on the right, and that's the one good thing I can say that the Common Core State Standards did is it created absolute unity for disparate reasons. Those on the right have their reasons for not liking the Common Core State Standards, and those on the left have their position about the Common Core State Standards. But the one thing I do want to emphasize, it was no conspiracy. It started happening a long time ago. And what we're seeing now is the fruition of the efforts to privatize. So how does the Common Core, how does it play into the whole move to privatize education? I think that's sort of the big question. In the early days, in 1989, when we had Clinton, he was still a president, and we had Goals 2000 being promoted, and they're still reeling from, we're still looking at a nation at risk in 1983, proposing that the public schools were all failures. The one thing that was clear, and when I read about this era, is that they didn't have the right kind of data to use to privatize education. Because what you had to do is you had to have data that was basically nationwide based on standardized tests to demonstrate that public schools were not doing their job and that private industry could do a better job. And so that's why you see in 1998, you see the American Diploma Project talking about benchmarking standards and assessment at the same time. So the need was to have a national set of assessments that could be used to compare state to state, district to district, school to school, and in the end, it would be teacher to teacher. In order to have that kind of set of data, you had to have a national test. Well, you have to rationalize having a national test. And how do you do that, James? You have to have a national set of standards and thus a national curriculum. So the move was always there to have this national test in place. And the Common Core State Standards provided the impetus to have that test. So it's always been about the assessment and the standards linked to the assessment.
The money.
Well, you're right, and there's your privatization. The people who were involved in the very beginning, the Fordham Foundation. You have Chester Finn in 1996, shortly after the creation of ACHIEVE and that same year with the Palisades Conference. He's in Georgia, and he's talking to a group of businessmen, and he's saying, you know, we have this new market. I mean, it's like the biggest market ever. It's unbelievable, this market. I mean, you could make a dime, if you're a savvy investor. And so it was always about the money. We had the Lehman Brothers, who went under recently through in the recession through their hinky business practices, and sponsored the Education Industry Investment Conference in New York in February 1996. At the same time, we're planning the coup for how we're going to take over education. And here's a quote. Conferees, this is from Douglas Dewey, who attended the conference. Conferees were regaled with new opportunities in a $600 billion industry, including preschool, K-12, post-secondary, and training and development. And then he went on to write for the Freeman. Corporate entrepreneurship in the education field held the promise of finally eliminating government from education completely. He says, as public confidence in government schooling continues its inexorable collapse, and the whiff of billions begins stirring in the air, the savvy investor will focus his attention on the greatest emerging market in decades and treat government schools as just another competitor to blow out of the water. And there you have it. I think that kind of boils down, you know, that solidifies the intent here. It was always about money. It was never about children. It was never about eliminating poverty. It was never about making the lives of our children better. It was about making money. And there has been a lot of money made, and there will continue to be a lot of money made. The one thing I've noticed, James, if you're following, I'm sure you're following the ESEA reauthorization process in Washington. We have Lamar Alexander, and he's leading the charge. So there's a lot of discussion about, well, you know, Lamar Alexander, I mean, he's for local control of public schools. I mean, he's the guy. He understands. And yet, one thing that nobody's taught, I shouldn't say nobody, but the one thing that's being missed is that basically Lamar Alexander's proposal for the reauthorization of ESEA could have been written in 1992 when he was the Secretary of the Department of Education under H.W. Bush. Because the thing that nobody wants to talk about is the fact that what he's preserving is the charter school funds and the privatization of education through charters, and he believes strongly in the voucher concept. And so ESEA, although, you know, some people are trying to find, you know, the silver lining there, it's nothing more than 1992 all over again, where he's giving lip service to local control. I mean, he made a wonderful speech the other day. I mean, I watched it and I thought, that sounds great. He's talking about local control of public schools. But just a year ago, he said on a panel discussion that local government operate a monopoly over over education issues. So he used the Friedman concept of the monopoly. At the same time, now he's being sort of lauded as this heroic man who's bringing together the right and the left, and he's going to restore local control over public schools. I'm not buying it, and of course, we don't know how the ESEA reauthorization is going to go at this point, whether it's going to eliminate the Common Core. I don't know, because, again, the Common Core was not developed by the Department of Education. It was supposedly developed by governors, but in reality, it was developed by the corporate world in full. And so, you know, and now we have all these states who have already adopted the Common Core. They've just changed the name. In New York, we call them the New York State Standards. We don't call them necessarily the Common Core. We know that's what they are. And in other states, they just renamed them. So I don't know that they're going anywhere. And certainly we know the testing is not going anywhere, because Lamar Alexander this committee has made sure that we're going to maintain annual testing. And so, you know, I don't know how that's going to work out. We'll just have to
Got about a minute. You have about a minute, possibly a minute and a half, before we have to start wrapping up.
Okay. Let me just say this. I think that we're seeing a time where we have an opportunity to take back our education. I think a couple of notes here, and this is in the last chapter of my book. I want to make this point that one thing we need to be careful of, or we need to be very vigilant about and be very vigilant, is really listening to candidates in local elections, state elections, and federal elections. And when anybody begins a conversation that says basically that our schools need reform, that our schools are failing, understand that's code. And that's code for this. That politician knows it's much easier to get to work on education reform and to blame schools than it is to actually tackle the hard policies that are involved with poverty and inequality in this country. It's too messy to tackle all those issues, and so we need to hold them accountable for that. The other thing is that parents have rights. And I say in the book, with no ill will or rancor towards your school, just exercise your right as a parent to say, I can determine what's best for my child. And if I choose not to have my child sit and be a source of capital for a company and to sit and take tests that are punitive and that are harmful to children, then I have the right to do that. And I urge parents to continue to do that and to continue to talk about that. We need to be, I think one thing that we need to do is to remove corporate influence from education policy, root and branch, to borrow a line from the Brown v. Board 2 decision. Root and branch say they have no place in our public school system. If they want to tinker around with education, they can do it with private schools, and that's their right in this country, but to leave our public schools alone and let us get down to the business of actually teaching children. Don't allow anyone to speak ill of public school teachers. Public school teachers are doing a job that is not well paid. We spend our days with the children. We're there for the most part because we love to be with children, and teachers are doing an excellent job, and we need to be vigilant about that. And the most important thing is maintain the autonomy of your local school boards. Hold the local school boards accountable, but work towards maintaining their autonomy. And we need to be aware of who our local school boards are and to be active as parents. Be vigilant. Don't give up. Keep up the fight. Embrace your public schools. Maintain the democratic control over public schools. And then the last thing I want to say is we need to stop closing public schools. You can't improve a school if once you close it. So once you close the school and turn it into a charter school, you forever change the landscape of education in your area, in your local district, and we need to maintain our public schools and work towards improving them. And finally, make your voice heard.
You know, that was more than a minute and a half, right? I mean, you are a teacher.
I know. So I kept waiting for you to butt in. I'm used to my husband, Tom Fiala, you know.
Mean, you don't want to
and
say
he
that
stops
I
me dead
got
in the
it.
Track.
And you're the one who said that I got it. I understood it. I mean, you got all those accolades. I didn't want to cut you off. I started to. But anyway.
Well, I appreciate
here's
that.
Here's what I wanted to say. Chapter 7 is perhaps, and 8 are the real meat of the book. Chapter 7 is called Education Reform in the Deep State. An alternative universe. I said, basically, entering the twilight zone is what that chapter is all about, that the alternative state. Chapter 8, the Common Core Standard, Systemic Education Reform Writ Large. Translated, the Machiavellian Agenda Unleashed. It's the plan how we're going to destroy public education and erect a privatized education at the public expense. That, to me, was the gist there. And at the very end, when you have all of this put together, I sort of tried to pull it together for myself, and I will try and share that. It's got a few seconds here. And Chapter 9 is called The Gorilla in the Room for the Free Market Education Reform. Trying to put 7, 8, and 9 together, I said, the unleashing of their Machiavellian agenda creates an alternative universe, a twilight zone world, the attempt would be to destroy public education and the erection of public privatized education. And the power of the free market education reform is firmly put in place and in control, and sitting in the control seat of this new house of privatization will be the 800-pound gorilla that you've been talking about throughout the book. Now, had I not had these three shows, what I want you to know in my written review that I will send to you sometime when I get it all polished up is that I'm saying to everyone, this is the book that you need. It should be required reading in all levels of teacher preparation courses, continuing ed for veteran teachers and parents. This is a basic an advanced manual for all classes in public education for resistors and our supporters. This is the one book for those who want and need only one book to read and reread, to study, to become knowledgeable about what is happening today, how we got here, and what and who is responsible, and what we need to do and what we can do to take back the future of our public education system for our kids. That was the gist of all of this.
Thank you.
Now, with that, I have run over time. I will say that hopefully next week we'll try and wrap this up. I'm trying to get some of the people from New York who are leading this fantastic resistance movement there and opt out. And hopefully if I can do that, we'll have four or five people on a panel and we'll talk about what's going on. So with that, I thank everyone and say, as I always do, have a great Sunday evening, afternoon. I did it in reverse order. And see you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.